Alrighty, it is 6 o'clock.
Is it?
It is. We are live and recording. Martin, I will have you go ahead and open.
Okay, I will open the meeting. Open the meeting June 10th. We're going to open the Planning Commission. Roll call.
Martin?
Here.
Ryan?
Here.
Lloyd?
Here.
Robert?
Present.
And Kelly is absent. And it looks like we just need to do approval of minutes.
Okay, so we need to approve the minutes, correct?
Yes, from...
I make a motion, yes. I wasn't here, so Lloyd's going to do the motion.
He already made the motion.
You made the motion. You seconded it. Okay. So
now we're caught up.
Okay.
No.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
I'm abstaining since I wasn't there.
All right. I do believe that's it. And Ben, you have the floor.
Okay.
I'm going to
display the
this...
presentation.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Hopefully.
Thank you.
Hold on 1 second. There it is. I think.
So we also have... Adam Cares, who's part of the consultant team that's with us tonight. You'll see a lot of the work products that we share are items that he's been the lead on. Adam, you want to introduce yourself real quickly, please?
Hi, everybody. Adam Cares. My company is ACGO and partnered with White Bluffs and working on open space, energy overlay, and industrial lands.
Great. Thanks, Adam.
Yeah.
So if we'll go to the next slide, just a reminder on the general timeline that we're on here. So we've got the end of the kind of the first half of the project is actually later this month. In fact, we're getting Brittany a bunch of draft deliverables that she'll provide to the state to meet our the county's requirements for the grant. But we've been doing a lot of analysis, right? You can see that first arrow there, plan analysis. Now that we're largely completed, like the initial draft analysis, there'll still be refinement of it, but it's largely in place, or now we'll be tweaking it. Then we'll transition to goals and policies and developing more specifically the updated sections of the plan. Still shooting for adoption next spring. As I mentioned in the past, we also have an environmental impact statement. Scoping process has been completed. We'll talk about that here in a minute. And then, of course, we want to receive public input throughout the planning process. And we have, I see Debbie Berkowitz on the meeting as well. Hi, Debbie. Debbie and I have worked together on the City of Richland projects in the past. So glad to have you joining us.
Ben, thank you.
You're welcome. So that's the general timeline. We have two workshops this month, this one, which may feel like a lot of information, but don't worry, it just gets worse. there'll be more coming later in the month. Next slide, please. So we're just going to touch bases on the scoping report.
Is it moving?
No. Sorry. Oh, is that one extra?
That's it. That's the one.
Okay.
So give you just a quick update on the comments we received from scoping. Talk about critical areas, open space, energy overlay, industrial lands, and next steps. There's only like 40 slides, so couldn't take more than 3 or 4 hours tonight. So scoping report, next slide. If you know, I'm a kidder, so if you don't like it, just tell me to stop and I'll stop. But I will keep bringing the snacks. So for the EIS, we have the scoping that was done. The county has determined that, you know, we're likely having a significant adverse environmental effect. As we talked about, the county's EIS was from the 80s, right? So highly outdated. So are we going to have a major environmental effect? There's going to be some effects. There's going to be some protection and preservation. It's a mixed bag, but we're going to evaluate the effects of it all. Three alternatives were developed. Scoping ended in late April. We did receive some scoping comments. They cover their start on the next slide. And we got, oh, I'm sorry. just a reminder of the alternatives. So the one alternative is no action or no change to kind of the current designations. The alternative two is more like aggressive growth and like higher intensity development. And alternative three is what we're calling moderate growth with more limited industrial and energy development than alternative two. So you have kind of no action and alternative three and alternative two is, or alternative two as the most aggressive, most impactful. And then alternative three is the one in the middle. Next slide. We received three comments from the state, Department of Ecology, State Fish and Wildlife, and Benton PUD. As you might imagine, DFW focused a lot on the shrub step protection, make sure we have the right information sources, that we're updating the critical areas code elements using the latest guidance documents from the agencies. And that's both Ecology and DFW said that. Making sure that we're addressing the new housing requirements. So that's where we're getting into, you know, basically trying to provide opportunities for housing for a range of different incomes that we see in the county. And then for future energy projects, note that transition limitations exist, and also that there's quite a bit of land that's required for renewable energy for the amount of power it produces. Next slide.
The delay.
Maybe. Hold on. Does that look right?
I think we missed one.
You want me to go back?
Yes, please.
This is.
There you go. So there were two scoping comments.
Oh, okay.
No worries. It looks very similar, but it is not the same.
Okay.
So another comment we received was use the State Fish and Wildlife energy, renewable energy, and landscape management tools to protect priority fish and wildlife species and their habitats. The state has a new guidance document that's out for renewable energy projects specifically. It's a draft guidance document. Adam, has that been finalized yet?
No, it hasn't. I actually got in touch this past week, and they said they expect it soon, but it's not ready yet.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Address the interaction between open space and critical areas and encourage development away from critical areas. And we're going to touch on what we're looking at in terms of open space tonight. And then use the latest Department of Fish and Wildlife guidance for designating and updating riparian management zones and the width of those zones. So we call those riparian buffers right now in your different documents, but this new term, RMZ, or riparian management zones, is what we're going to as we go through the update. Next slide, please. So critical areas. Next slide. So we've got several updates that we're making to the critical areas code, primarily in the wetlands section, because we did a lot of updates on the other sections in 2021. But best available science sources, we've had several, you know, if you remember in the critical areas code, there's a codified part of the critical areas protection, and then there's a best available science document that is not codified, but it is accompanying the critical areas code. So we've updated some of the source documents that are the best available science that we're relying on to include the latest fish and wildlife documents, guidance documents, and also the ecology's latest wetlands guidance. In chapter 1502, which is basically kind of the general provisions as well as definitions, as I mentioned earlier, buffer has now been changed to riparian management zone. So instead of riparian buffer, it's riparian management zone, or RMZ. And then updated the definitions, a few different definitions. Chapter 1504 is the wetlands chapter. And we talked about, again, consistent with the latest guidance, wetland delineations typically only last 5 years. If there hasn't been a specific change in conditions, and an applicant can demonstrate that a 6 or a 7 or a 10-year-old wetland report is still valid, it can be used. but probably with some additional due diligence and like a supplemental letter that goes along with it or something like that.
So these are being driven by the state Fish and Wildlife?
And our State Department of Ecology in the case of wetlands.
Okay, because the federal guidelines have been relaxed, is my understanding.
They may have been relaxed, which is probably going to mean the state's going to tighten theirs up even more.
Yeah, probably.
But yeah, so we're looking at the state requirements here. And granted, there's a federal, a couple different, you know, like a federal regional supplement that is used also in the wetland delineation. That document hasn't changed that I know of. So that also gets factored in. And that's part of the guidance documents that we're referencing.
Okay.
Next slide, please. Also in wetlands, we're updating and reorganizing some of the activities that are allowed in wetlands. Nothing really new here, but things were kind of scattered around and we've consolidated them and verified that we've captured kind of everything that the state guidance allows for. So like gathering berries and other things, low intensity, temporary impact activities. The biggest change that we made in wetlands is we updated the way that you score functions for a wetland, the way that you delineate the wetland, and then the buffer widths that apply based upon those functional scores. So, and the required measures to minimize impacts, because there are specific things that you know, if it scores this, you have to do required measures to minimize impacts, and then you can mitigate beyond that. But it's kind of like, you know, if you remember the mitigation sequencing, the first thing is to avoid the impact. Second is to minimize the impact. And third is to mitigate the impact. So in the mitigation requirements, it talks about, hey, you have to do these specific minimization measures prior to going to mitigation. And so we've updated those. So you'll see in 1504, when you get the draft document, as you guys look through it, as we get farther in the process, has the Planning Commission received that document? So you could receive it any time, or it's out on the county's website, right?
Yeah, I don't think they've got the copy of the draft yet.
Okay, it's available. And most of the track changes are in this section about the scoring, the delineation, the mitigation. We added in some specific conditions for stormwater facilities, more like low impact development stormwater facilities, updated mitigation requirements and options. So on-site is first priority, off-site compensatory is kind of second. And you can do that through like a mitigation bake or in lieu fee mitigation. We updated the mitigation ratios based upon the different types of whether it's protection or restoration, that kind of thing. Next slide, please. So that was basically it for wetlands. Like I say, you'll see most of the changes in there. And then chapter 15.14, which is the fish and wildlife habitat conservation areas. Really, all we've done there is riparian management zones are now what we call the buffers, as I mentioned earlier. And then local studies can also help inform best available science sources. I will say DFW would like to see all of the buffers that are on any stream in the county be a minimum of 100 feet, and that's per their guidance document. We have it less than that in areas where we, you know, identified that there was less function to protect, except when there's steep slopes. And so then if there's the potential for like sediment to come into the stream, you know, from upland development, then you do go up 100 feet or to the top of the bluff.
You guys may remember that back in 2021, we processed that change.
Yeah.
Trying to create some flexibility in those areas.
So DFW doesn't love what we did in 2021. I think it's still defensible because it's an adequate area. I mean, some of these places, it truly is only water quality that you're protecting from because there's no habitat. Like go out on Spring Creek in certain sections, you know, there's farming right up to the edge of it. And that's voluntary stewardship program. So then you're just looking at water quality protections, and if it's flat, it's very difficult to have overland flow, right, that's going to affect that. So 100 feet just seems overly conservative, particularly when there's already quite a bit of, like, disturbance on some of these systems. We will likely receive additional comments on that from DFW and maybe also from members of the public about that. And we'll work through that. If there's an opportunity to make some modifications or give you a few different options, you can decide kind of how you want to proceed, like no change or make some updates. Next slide. Open space recommendations. Oh, wait, here we go. So, okay, so now we're on to open space. It's okay, we skipped two slides, it's fine. So one of the things that we have to do in open space is we have to now this year, and as part of this update, identify open space corridors within and between urban growth areas. So you've got urban growth areas pretty much on every city, and we have to look at open space corridors between those, like between Retchen and Kennewick, or between Benton City and Prosser, and then also within those UGAs, what are the open space corridors and recreation and fish and wildlife functions and conditions that that need to potentially be protected. So we characterize the environmental functions and patterns of use within these identified open space corridors, and then review strategies to align protection of open space corridors with other policies and plans and make recommendations.
Got a question.
Yes, sir.
So on the west side, a lot of those open space corridors are Forest Service ground, federal ground, all this kind of stuff. Over here, it's all private land. Okay, so how do you designate protecting open space when you're going directly against somebody's rights to use that property?
So I don't think actually when you see the map, and Adam's going to jump in here, and that's a really good question. But you still have like KID canals that traverse. You have large blocks of public land in certain areas.
You just got state ground and stuff. Yeah.
And so that's what we're focused on. Okay. We're not focused on the private ground.
Unless the private land.
Okay.
Yeah, if someone wants to come up.
Wants to do it.
Yeah. Right.
And we have some people that have done that in West Richland over there for their gun clubs and stuff like that.
Yes, exactly.
That's more voluntary. We're focusing more on public lands.
Yep. Yep.
Okay.
All right. For those very reasons.
Okay.
So, next slide. All right, Adam, take it away. So Adam's going to walk through the analysis that he's done and some of the more specific recommendations and findings.
So this first map just shows existing open space designations, land use designations, and there's one. And it's about 2,000 acres. And remind me the name of the ranch. Ben.
Barker Ranch,
yeah.
Yeah.
So you get kind of an idea of the extent of that land use designation currently. And then, as Ben mentioned, the new requirement is specific to open space within and between urban growth areas. So while we considered countywide data, our focus was really on that what was required, which is that within and between requirement. So we're kind of we're sort of zoomed in to a belt kind of right in the middle of the county between the cities and the urban growth areas. Next slide, please. Okay, so this shows you sort of an overview of aggregated open space layers. So in identifying corridors, we took all of the things that that are mentioned in the statute and in Benton County's planning documents that relate to open space, like habitat layers, critical areas, recreation areas and parks and preserves, and kind of stacked all those together. So you can see in the green shading, those are all of those layers. And when they kind of get darker, that's because there's multiple open space areas that overlap on the landscape.
Adam.
And then in the darker blue, you can see what we've identified as corridors within and between urban growth areas. So those are areas that are providing that connection both of habitat and environmental functions and of recreational access and trails and some public use. So either one of those things could be what is driving this identification as a corridor. And then the little dark hatching you can see on top of that is lands that are already in public ownership or some form of open space protection. So you can see the Barker Ranch is also shaded there. And you can see labels on the map as well. So we've kind of tried to characterize the functions of those open space corridors. Some of them are very different from others. You have the Horse Heaven Foothills that is mostly habitat, shrub step habitat, and steep slopes. It has scenic values, but it's primarily just open lands that are providing ecosystem functions and some very limited public use and recreation, as opposed to, say, Red Candy and Badger Mountain ridgetops, where you have the preserves and much heavier public use. So I'll pause here in case there's any questions on this.
Yeah. There's kind of a salmon color. What is that?
Those are the urban growth areas.
Okay.
You can kind of get a feel for the interconnected system here within and between. And obviously, as you look wider, there is plenty of open space and habitat that doesn't fall into this definition of a corridor within and between UGAs, but is still open space and could still be suitable for protection, but doesn't necessarily fit with this component of the comprehensive plan.
Or maybe another way to say it, if I can maybe add to that, okay. Adam, and maybe another way to say it is that this answers the requirement, right, that we have in the state guidance for the update of the plan. We know there are other open space priorities, that, like shrub step mitigation and other factors that will happen in other areas, but could also happen within these corridors. That doesn't mean we're ignoring that. That just means it's being addressed through a separate, but related part of the comprehensive plan update. And we'll be sharing information with you on a shrub step mitigation program that we're trying to formulate right now as we get to our meetings in the fall. So it's a complementary effort to this work that Adam has focused on looking within and between the UGAs.
Okay, now we can go to the next slide.
Okay. Wasn't sure.
All right. So within that larger map, we identified several priority areas where we're looking at actual potential designations and where they might make sense. And so this first area, this is Candy Mountain Preserve. Most of this is already designated as public land use designation in the comprehensive plan. So the majority is already protected, but there you can see that BLM parcel on the north end. That piece could potentially be suitable for either open space or parks or public land use designation. There's also a piece, you can see there's a little square that we initially flagged that's owned by the city of West Richland. And that one, I think there's plans to put a water tower out there. But that one is not, I don't think, currently under parks. But anyway, this was the first area that we reviewed. The BLM piece, we are still yet to discuss with BLM what the avenues might be for placing open space protection on that property. Anything to add, Ben?
No, I just think that there is one property in there that is part of the West Richland urban growth area. That's also kind of part of the park plans, and Michelle has a specific strategy for how to address that in the future, and stay tuned for more details. That's just kind of a teaser.
You're so funny.
I mean,
okay.
Is that incorrect?
Next slide.
Oh, I just have some ideas. We're working with our parks department to try to figure out how to expand the backside of Candy.
Okay. So how big a parcel is that?
Adam, what's the size of that?
Of the UGA piece?
Yeah, the Benton County parcel that's in the UGA.
I want to say less than 20 acres.
Give me a second. But it's, yeah, it looks like it's like 80, right? It looks like half of 160. So
yeah,
probably a little under 80.
Okay. Yeah. It's...
The one that's around the water tower?
No, the UGA Benton County parcel.
Oh, you're talking about Badger?
No, Candy.
That is the UGA parcel?
Yeah.
It's 17.
Oh, so these are not 160s there.
Oh, sorry, 17 plus, yeah.
Okay.
BLM is what, a quarter section then?
Do you have that, Michelle, the BLM?
The one on the backside?
Yeah, north.
That is 37 and change.
All right, next slide.
Well, not major changes. Not a huge expansion of this area, but some low-hanging fruit that might make sense. So next on to Badger. Again, majority is already protected. It's already designated as public. But you can see once again the pink catching, those are within the city of Richland's UGA. They are also the designation in the city's comprehensive plan is open space as well. But again, I think looking at a strategy to remove them from the UGA might be applicable. Okay, next
one. And there's a little corner. It's not specifically called out right now, but you can see where the trail goes through the private property on the west side. So where it's not cultivated or hasn't been cultivated in the past, basically that steeper hillside where the trail is, that'd be a good opportunity area also to acquire and receive an open space designation. Mm-hmm. All right.
Next one. Here we go. Ben, do you want to talk about this one? You've got a lot of context.
Yeah, you bet. Thank you, Adam. So the third area that we're looking at, you may not be as familiar with. This map shows Badger Canyon. It is just west of I-82 and Clearwater Badger Road connection. Cottonwood Springs is right there on the right, lower right corner of this figure. And then you've got some irrigated ground. There are two parcels that are shown here. The one larger one to the west is owned by Washington State Department of Natural Resources. It's basically that hillside that is kind of between Badger Canyon, and then up at the top, the hilltop up above it.
Are you talking about the blue area?
Yeah, the blue area is DNR.
You got Sunset View or whatever up above.
Sunset View.
Summit View.
Summit View. I know it was something like that.
So the west larger parcel is owned by DNR, and the other parcel is 160-acre DNR BLM property.
That's light colored area up in the upper left hand corner.
Yes, the lighter color. So the two blocks shaded. Canal goes through there, I think. Yeah, canal goes through that one and along the edge of the DNR.
Yeah.
So these are opportunities that kind of emerged from the analysis that Adam was doing. That these are areas that could be also designated as open space, and in fact, we're doing even more than that for these properties if we are able to. You can see the red dashed line through the property. Those are some existing kind of informal trails that have been created. People hike through there, they mountain bike. In the winter, I'm sure there's dirt bikes and four-wheelers. There's other roads. And so, yeah. There's someone that has put up shooting
target.
Yeah, like plates, metal plates.
Yeah.
So you might hear tink, tink, you know.
I haven't been out there to see those.
Okay, yeah. They're
to go explore.
They're up there. So anyway, we're going to come back to this one in a little bit more detail. We'll go to the next slide and hit the recommendations, and then we're going to do a little deeper dive into these two properties.
So would the BLM be willing to help develop that into something recreational? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so the way you could do it is you do a lease through them, and then down the road, maybe potentially apply for title of that property. So like the county could do a lease, just like they did out at the shooting range.
Right, over there on Horn Road.
Exactly. Right. Go through that same process. You know, get the lease, do the improvements for whatever the plan is for the area, and then
apply for
ownership. Yeah, they call it a patent, but it's basically getting ownership of it. But we'll come back to that. So, Adam, you want to hit on these recommendations for the open space, just general memo that we put together, and then we'll do a deeper dive back into those two properties.
Sure. So the first recommendation is to consider open space conservation or public land designations for publicly owned parcels that are adjacent to Candy Mountain, Badger Mountain, and the DNR and BLM parcels that we just showed you in Badger Canyon. And then also to explore strategies in the large block of contiguous BLM and DNR lands in the Horsehead Foothills and ways that either habitat restoration or public access might be improved on those properties. So really focused on properties that are already in some sort of public ownership and are adjacent to or within an area that's already seeing some public use and open space functions. Then the next recommendation is to work with the cities to identify and protect the open space corridors and resources within and between the UGAs, some of which are between UGAs are in the cities. So there's a need for dialogue between the county and the cities to establish protections for those areas.
If I can just jump in real quick. So we'll be having meetings with the cities individually later this month, in July into August, to have discussions around this and other topics as well. And so more to come as we have those meetings and then share the findings from them.
Thanks, Ben. And then next we have implement a variety of tools and management approaches to protect open space. So easements, land trusts, the shrub set mitigation bank, potentially. In the memo, we've got a whole list of preservation mechanisms that could be applied to protect the lands that are identified. And the last one, implementing early actions and protection strategies for those DNR and BLM properties in Badger Canyon. We're going to talk more about that in detail, but we've started that process of dialogue with both DNR and BLM.
Next. Great. Thank you, Adam. Next slide. All right. So here's these properties again. The DNR parcel is just under 270 acres. The BLM's 160. There is a lease parcel to the south, just left or west of the 1.5 circles that are shown there. That's under a grazing lease through DNR. And so next slide. This just shows you the topography. It's fairly steep up, you know, like maybe quarter way up the property going to the north on really both of them, but particularly the DNR property. The BLM property is a little flatter, but then you've got a lower area that's flat. When you get on the other side of the canal for BLM, it's pretty flat out there too. So you could have a variety of different trails and other things that could be included out there. One of the needs that has been identified for the community is to have a more dedicated place for mountain bikes. So Badger Mountain and Candy are primarily hiking. You can do some biking on the back part of Badger. This would still be like a multi-use area, so you could hike it. The vision is at this point, you could hike it, you could ride it. You wouldn't have, you know, like combustion fuel, dirt bikes or four-wheelers and stuff out there, which are out there today. Use it in the wintertime, I'm sure. And I've seen that. But this would be kind of a dedicated area with a plan that would be developed in coordination with the public to develop the trail system, but also largely keep it open space, particularly on the DNR property. The BLM could be maybe more intensively have more intense recreation development on it. DNR, they can't really do much with this. They can't lease it. They could sell it, you know, to somebody, and you might be able to put a few homes up top, but then you're going to have this hillside. It just seems like a great opportunity to dedicate it to the public and have all the neighborhoods around it be able to have access to it, you know, for hiking, for biking. Equestrian use, I think, would also be a good fit out there. And you could maybe have some dedicated trails where these are only mountain bike, these are, you know, everybody shares, these might be only equestrian, or, you know, however we get it, it would be worked out through a planning process. But that's a general idea. Next slide.
So, question.
Yes.
Who would be responsible for maintenance?
So, Evergreen Mountain Bike Association has there was a Shrub Step Trails Alliance that existed in the Tri-Cities. Mm-hmm. They just sunsetted that organization and converted to a chapter of the Evergreen Mountain Bike Alliance. And they we're meeting with them tomorrow night to see if they're open to both developing the trails and then also performing the maintenance, kind of like the Friends of Badger Mountain do for Badger and Candy. So it would have a similar kind of potential partnership there.
They better require high visibility clothing to go mountain bike in there.
Yeah, there's a lot of tall sagebrush. Seriously. No,
because there's opportunity to hunt birds there too. And so you would have mixed use potential.
I don't think there would be hunting in that.
It's
area.
County.
I know it's county.
It's legal.
Well, until it was changed to not be a permitted use, if that were the case.
That's my point.
So those are things
that have to be multi-use, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And not just dedicated to mountain bikers.
Or equestrian.
It doesn't matter, right?
Okay. So these are the things.
If you want to serve the public, you serve all the public. Not just a single group.
Okay.
When there's plenty of opportunity other places, Badger Mountain, Candy Mountain, there's trails. I've seen mountain bikes all the time on them.
Yeah.
I hike them. So we got to stay out of the stovepipe into one party.
Okay.
That's my point.
Sure, sure. And that would all get worked out in the management process.
Yeah. So in one of your slides, you had the dark blue area, and there's a lot of dark blue area along the I-82 corridor between Prosser and Benton City.
Yeah, back in the open space.
So that's all open for hunting over there.
Mm-hmm. It is. Know.
And equestrian and things like that, and those are thousands of acres of ground, you know. So you're talking 277 acres on the DNR and 160 acres on the BLM. So, you know, that's not a lot of ground to, you know, when you're talking about shooting and hunting, you know, that's pretty tough.
But it's shotgun or archery. Yeah. It's small range.
Archery now, that would be different. Yeah, right? For sure. Archery range.
In either case, and I've spent plenty of times in spaces where mixed use happens, where whether it be in LT Murray or North Pasco, where I've been out bird hunting or elk hunting, and had people doing mountain biking or just hiking during a hunting season.
Yeah.
And do not wear high vis. And they should.
Yeah.
It's just the safety thing with me. I don't care if they're out there. I don't care if they're riding their bike. I don't care if they're hiking or doing whatever.
Yeah.
Right? It's all public property. Mm-hmm. But be smart about it.
Yeah.
That's all.
Okay. Thank you for those comments. This shows you just kind of how this could fit in with the other ridge tops and that are already recreational areas, and you know, lower parts of the mountains as well. So,
yeah.
Next slide. And that just shows you some of the habitat. So up top, it gets a little less vegetated. There is like Cryptosporidium, so the fungus kind of that sits on top of the rocks.
Yeah. Lichens.
Lichens. Yeah.
Mollies don't want you to step on.
Exactly. and then you've got, as you mentioned, like really high stands of shrub, of sagebrush, and there's also quite a bit of bunch grass out there. There's a lot of cheatgrass too. Yeah.
Rabbit brush
is out there. Yeah. So it's a pretty nice piece of property, and has a lot of potential to help be a benefit to the community, and more usage.
Yeah, you've got some redwood sagebrush out there. Pretty good sized stuff. Yeah,
there's some big sagebrush.
Yeah,
size.
Yeah.
Over your head's tall.
Yeah, stuff. Yeah. Yeah. Particularly some of those draws where they get the water.
Yeah.
All right. Next slide, please. So that just shows you the property kind of from Adam has a sweet drone that takes really awesome pictures. And so we're looking northeast there, and that gives you an idea of the DNR property and the BLM property and kind of what it looks like. It's kind of hard to tell, but you can see how the lower parts of it is, you know, less steep. So you could have maybe easier trails down low and then more steeper hiking or biking trails and stuff up higher.
So in the DNR property, does that border part of Clodfelder? Does that get close to Clodfelder up there?
No. Clodfelder's up on the next ridge.
Next ridge over.
It's basically on the top of that Horseheaven Hills corridor that Adam is showing.
So the access to that would be where? How would you get
How would you get access to this? You can get it through Summit View. The county has a long-term plan to extend Bermuda. I don't know that that will happen, but that could provide access. We also just saw an article today that showed basically right along the canal that BPA is looking at that as a route for one of their new transmission lines.
Getting a lot of resistance, I guarantee.
Oh, I'm sure.
The canal route will not be used just because of the feedback they're getting, and there's actually right now a lot of resistance on the railroad route. That's their primary route that they want to use because of all the trees along Badger.
Yeah,
they're along that route are going to come down if they do that, and so that impacts owls, hawks,
yep.
All your riparian.
Yeah,
you know, and I. It's out my backyard.
Yeah.
I see it from my house.
Yep.
All the trees, all the wildlife, and turkey that we've seen recently, pheasant and quail, all that habitat will be impacted significantly by the rail route.
Yep.
Especially the trees with their, you know.
Yep. Yep.
Which are few.
So where do we go from here? Well, we're going to incorporate the findings, next slide, please, into the comprehensive plan, right, for the larger open space effort that Adam was discussing. We'll receive public input and comment on all of our recommendations and strategies. There's probably things that we haven't thought about that others might, you know, want to throw into the mix. I mentioned we're meeting with Evergreen to talk about the partnership on the DNR and potentially the BLM property. Yeah, DNR has said, you know, the probably the most effective way to proceed with that property once we kind of decide that we have enough kind of critical mass to handle this, mm-hmm. is to go through a trust land transfer process that actually happens through the state legislature, where the state pays DNR for the value that the school system would have received if they had done something with it, mm-hmm. kind of, you know, developed it, so, you know, at some level, and then that gets a dollar amount, it goes into their budget, and then the transfer process happens
so
after that.
So, like, how does the county get plugged into that meet and greet with Evergreen Mountain Bike Alliance group?
About meeting with? Yeah, so we can get you involved down the road. This first meeting is just to discuss, you know, it's first. There, well, they'll have a meeting. The Evergreen Mountain Bike Alliance will have, the local chapter will have a meeting to discuss this. And that meeting I could let you know about.
And the land transfer process is a 2 to 3 year process.
Yeah. Probably. Yep. And public.
Yeah. They work at DNR, the legislature, and the county, and go through that whole process.
The reason I bring that up is there's interest. I'm a Pheasants Forever member of the local chapter.
Yeah.
President of National Wild Turkey Federation. So from a habitat standpoint, habitat improvement or retention, if you will.
Yes.
There's vested interest there because I know there's pheasants up there.
Yeah.
And there is a turkey running around Badger Canyon that's been seen, wild turkey.
Yeah.
So.
And we also quail, have a DFW quail. We saw quail and doves out there.
Hundreds of quail.
Yeah, jackrabbits.
There is.
Yep, jackrabbits.
They just keep committing suicide on Badger Road too many times, but yeah.
Well, these ones up there are on the other side of the canal, so maybe they're a little separated.
They travel a little bit. But
yeah, sure.
No.
But the other thing that I wanted to bring up is we have also discussed this open space, all this open space information that you're receiving tonight. We also met with Fish and Wildlife, Department of Fish and Wildlife on that as well. They have some suggestions on protecting habitat values in this area as well. And I think the Evergreen and the local kind of recreation users that would like to have access to trails and stuff also have open space and habitat considerations that they want to see as well. So I think there's a critical mass there of kind of consensus that we can get to.
Mm-hmm. I was sitting there thinking they've got 30,000 acres sitting over there at Hanford. You know, if they want to open up some of that property for hunting and whatever access for, you know, they could do part of that too.
Yeah.
But I don't see that they're going to probably do that. So
not for many, many, many years.
Yeah.
With all the tank farms that we have to
solidify
in the glass, it's going to start here real soon. So.
Yeah. I know.
But that's 40-year lifespan.
We're not the right ethnicity on that. So anyway.
Are we wearing you out yet?
No. This has actually got me pretty energized.
All right. Oh, you better go get some more snacks.
Yeah, I'm good.
Okay. Adam?
Good time to be energized because now it's time to talk about energy overlay.
Oh, perfect. All right, so next slide. So why are we doing an energy overlay? Well, you know the answer.
Yeah.
But we've had a lot of projects. This isn't all of them. There are others that have been proposed and haven't been made public, but you can see there's a lot of activity both with what exists and then what's been proposed and approved by FSEC or withdrawn or under review. And so we've been trying to be proactive in saying, all right, well, as we get considered for future energy projects, how do we want that to occur? And so Adam's going to give you an overview of the analysis that he did, the energy overlay proposal draft, very draft proposal that we have formulated, and that we'll be working with you and, of course, the county staff on refining over the next 6 to 7 months, maybe 6 to 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
Adam, take it away. Next slide, please.
Okay, so you can see on this slide, the two main considerations when we were looking at energy overlay is the protection of agricultural lands and the protection of habitat. And then a third element, there's less geographic extent of these others, but also wetlands and steep slopes. And if you look at that table of existing energy projects that Ben shared and map that on the landscape, most of those projects are in the GMA ag zone. And so there are already planned significant projects that will impact agricultural lands and agricultural activities. And knowing that and knowing the background of the FSEC process and many of the comments and concerns that were associated with the siting of those facilities, our approach was to try to find areas with the least level of conflict with protected agricultural lands and higher value agricultural lands and with habitat. So really trying to overlay those two things and do a spatial exercise to find the areas that locally have the least conflict. There are really no areas when you take WSDA's agricultural lands and the PHS layer and put those both on the map, there's very little left between those two. And most of the areas that are not protected agricultural lands or higher value agricultural lands where you have irrigation or you have really suitable soils, almost all of those areas are either steep slopes and or shrub steppe or other habitats. So it's a difficult exercise to kind of find the margins in between where there's a higher level of suitability. Next slide, please.
What kind of projects are under consideration?
So this is that map that we showed you maybe at our April workshop. So like there's the Horsehaven Hills wind farm, right? Yeah.
Wind projects, solar projects.
Yeah, then there's wind and solar projects. Like, and maybe if Adam could share his screen, we have that, or maybe, yeah, so we have a map that shows all those areas. Maybe we can just email it to you after the fact, but it shows that a lot of the county is, you know, when you consider what's in application, there's quite a large chunk of ground that's proposed for renewable energy.
We've already had Benton PUD here telling us that the county does not receive anything long term from any projects. So what benefit would the county have of going through with them?
The FSEC ones are outside of the county's control.
Yep.
Right. The county gets to provide comment and they can take legal action.
And it was all ignored. Inslee signed it the day before he left office.
Yep, exactly. So Greg asked us to say, hey, where and how, why might we do an energy project? You could have an energy project like a solar project that could, you know, serve businesses in Benton County. You could have even smaller, like, for a farm that has power. So there are applications where energy could work. You could have, other types of energy projects in a smaller scale in different areas.
Okay. If I can just add. Please. So I know we're all thinking large scale, which that's been what's been at our back door with the wind and the solar. So this isn't just wind and solar. These are other types of energy uses. So if small nuclear reactors come on board, perhaps it would be appropriate to site that in an industrial zone, as Ben was stating.
Yeah.
I've also had very in-depth conversations with a farm who wants to create energy using farm food waste. And that would be cited in the energy overlay. So although we're thinking large scale, more than likely those projects are going to go through FSEC and completely bypass the county. But it is possible that we could help a farmer site a biodigester on his property to create energy and natural gas to put it back into the grid system. And it's helping him out and benefiting our community. So there are some instances. So we can't just pigeonhole ourselves into the large scale renewable projects, although it may apply to them as well. But what we're finding so far, if we're going to be looking at the maps, is you'll see we're not finding another 72,000 acres of the Horsehaven Wind Farm. We're finding, you know, a couple hundred acres here and there maybe. So they're going to be a little bit smaller.
And I think back in 2018, 2020, 2021, when this started to pick up and we started to get these inquiries, we didn't have this kind of study done. We had a thing in our code that required a conditional use permit, but we didn't have a lot of studies to help drive where these type of things would be ideal for going. And that's part of the motivation here, was to have Ben and his team go and try to figure out where, based upon all the different criteria and all the different facts, where could something like this go? Where would be the least amount of impact to all the different criterias? And we didn't have that. It would have really been helpful when we were making the arguments for or against at the FSEC level, saying, hey, here in Benton County, we've done this analysis. The state's done all their analysis. We've been a part of some of those studies. And we didn't like how they manipulated the data necessarily to come up with where they felt like the least impact areas would be.
You know what the least impact area is? On the roofs of businesses and homes.
Yeah. Sure.
Throw some panels on every home and every business in the area. You wouldn't need to take up acres and acres and acres of land with solar panels.
Well, the new energy codes are requiring those type of things on new businesses. But with that, we really wanted to have this type of analysis and study done. And so we're appreciative of Ben in doing that. And it helps us then figure out, like Michelle was saying, where could we potentially do it? And there's different types of energy uses that may want to go and land in there. It's not going to be an easy test to make in Benton County to place something like this. But at least we have the study, we have the analysis done. So when we do get inquiries, we can say yay or nay, or hey, maybe over here, but you're going to have to meet all of this criteria. So the door might be open, but not a hole. And it's not going to be big. If it's going to be a large commercial, they're going to go through FSEC, because it doesn't meet the test here in Benton County. No. So.
And Greg said Ben, but really Adam did 95% of the work on this. He and I worked on some stuff, but I got him involved. But the credit all goes to him for doing all the hard work on this and some really good analysis. He looked at a lot of different information, you know, where substations are, transmission lines, all of that. There's a lot of kind of supporting information that goes into these scenarios and recommendations that he's going to talk about next.
Thanks, Ben. So as we mentioned, I think we could go to the next slide if that's the map. I think the map might.
Let's talk about the zones. We're on scenarios.
Yeah. So we ran through three different scenarios to analyze what might be considered as protected agricultural lands, and what might be considered as lower conflict. So we didn't pigeonhole ourselves to one set of criteria. We kind of looked at three different ways. The first one was sort of the most conservative and was all agricultural lands mapped by WSDA, either irrigated or not, plus any high suitability soils as rated by NRCS. And so that was a very restrictive scenario. The second scenario, we took out the prime farmlands that are not irrigated and not currently being farmed. And then in the third scenario, we took out the non-irrigated agricultural lands that that are not in high suitability soils. So lands that aren't irrigated and have major limitations to their suitability for agriculture. So there's sort of a spectrum of how much we were considering as that protected agriculture in each of those scenarios. You can go to the next. Oh, so actually,
go back.
Let's talk about within each of those. So we use those to identify what would classify as zone one and zone two. And zones are really, that's kind of just a placeholder term for where we would have essentially a prohibition on energy development and where it might be allowed. And so in zone one, that's basically your protected agricultural lands where you really want to limit energy development to rooftops and existing develop areas. And zone two is the area we are considering as there might be a pathway to conditional use if a stringent set of criteria can be met. Now let's go to the map. So this is very preliminary draft. It's difficult to draw a box, but what we did is looked at that protected ag data set, and then habitat, steep slopes, and other critical areas on top of that, and then did a spatial exercise of trying to optimize where there was the most lower conflict agricultural land intersecting with the least of those other habitat constraints. And so that's what you see in the pink. And this is under the third scenario. So this is where dry land agriculture that is in lower suitability soils is considered in that zone too. So you could adjust this to any one of those three scenarios, and the boundaries of pink and green would shift. But the red boundary is what we're considering as the draft energy overlay, and that is the boundary of where we found the most of that optimization of larger extents of not protected agriculture, lower conflict agricultural lands, and less intersection with habitat in critical areas. So this is where we landed. You can see there are some larger areas, but a lot of it is the pivot corners and the margins, and doesn't really support significant scale. And if you put transmission on this, there are portions of those large open, the stuff in pink that would be unlikely to support energy development, just given the transmission capacity and what's available now. Comments on this map?
I think they're wowed. They're just like almost speechless. All right. Well, this is not your only bite at this apple, right?
Yeah.
Aren't you glad we're just not waiting until the end to just slam all of this on you? We're kind of dribbling it out.
Yep.
So that way, and we'll come back to some of these topics a couple different times, right? But you'll have a pretty good foundation, hopefully, over our workshops through the summer and into the early fall before we kind of give you the full draft plan with all this pulled together in it.
So how many workshops are you planning to together after we get this put together?
So you mean once the plan is drafted?
Right.
I think we've got about like maybe five or six total left. So a couple more, like we have the one later this month, okay. Then we'll take off July. We may come back again in August, September, October, then we'll do the whole draft plan, and then we'll have a couple more
afterwards,
early in like January, February,
March. Public meetings, all that fun stuff.
Yeah, right. All the public meetings, EIS, and of course everybody's invited to, we encourage people to come to these planning commission workshops to hear what's going on, because that's where you get the details, right? And have opportunity to provide input. More than when you get the draft product and it's not completely done, but it's largely been baked and there's been a lot of discussion. And
if you have a backstory.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you got the context.
Yep.
So this map, I think, is a really good start for an energy overlay. So there would be a code section that go along with this, that those conditional use provisions that Adam went through would be included in that code provision And we put it in the GMA Ag, I think is what we talked about, right? So
now this is all clipped to the GMA Ag, so it's strictly within.
Yeah. That's so it. you're seeing not only will you see this as a, you know, an overlay designation under land use, but then you'll also see some updates to goals and policies to reflect this, and then you'll see the zoning for how we would implement it. So you have planning and implementation kind of all addressed at one time. And that'll happen for everything that we're talking about, the open space, this, and the next topic, which is industrial lands. Segue, next slide. Industrial land, so again, Greg and Michelle said, all right, we just want to take a look at industrial lands and kind of within the regional context of where does Benton County fit with our existing industry, future industry opportunities? Do we need to change any designations, take land out of industrial designation, put land into industrial designation? You'll remember we changed, if you were involved in the 2018-2017 update, we took some lands that were industrial in a couple areas and turned them into GMA Ag. And some of those landowners have come back and said, hey, we had development plans and we've had some active proposals that we were entertaining, like options on property that when you change the designation on it, it just kind of killed them.
Right.
And so we're kind of revisiting ag and industrial kind of in parallel. Tonight we're talking about the industrial part of it. And again, you know, I'm just the mouthpiece up here. Adam did all the work and, you know, with input from Greg and Michelle, with input from me, of course. But so what we're going to walk through is the next slide shows kind of the regional context and all the different industrial land that exists. And then I'm going to let Adam take it away from here. But you can just see the light, medium industrial, like in Pasco, all of the heavy industry in Burbank and Findlay and Big Pasco and North Richland, and a little bit of that in Prosser,
right.
And Plymouth.
Right.
And then you got some light industrial business parks. And then, of course, you got all the Hanford stuff and energy. The bottom line is we have a lot of land identified for industrial. So would the county need any more land to be designated? Well, let's see. Adam, what do we need?
I would think so.
Thanks, Ben. Yeah, so when you do, the way we started this was with an inventory of industrial zoned lands. And when you start that way, the picture looks like we got tons of it between all these different jurisdictions. And then when you start to look at the localized trends and where it's actually occurring, the picture shifts a little bit. So we can go to the next slide. Okay, so this just really summarizes that there, on an acreage basis, there are large extents of industrial zoned lands. And that's before you incorporate the 40-some thousand acres of industrial zoned lands up in Hanford. But as I mentioned, there are location, there are area-specific needs within that, specific to certain communities. We can go to the next slide. Okay, so after we did our comprehensive inventory, we started looking at different scenarios for growth, industrial growth and demand, and how that might drive the need for industrial zone land in the future. And depending on how you do it, you can give yourself kind of a range of numbers, any number you might like based on what you think the growth scenario might be. So anywhere from 300 acres of demand to 3,500. And I honestly, in some scenarios with energy and server farms that are super land intensive, I think you could potentially even see a higher demand number than that, if know, if there are breakthroughs in technology or shifting trends, it's hard to predict. So we basically just threw out a range to give a broad sense of how things might play out. Next slide, please.
Hold on, it's just slow.
No worries. There it is. Okay, so in the county, in the unincorporated county, there's over 3,000 acres of industrial zoned land. Within that, we broke it into different tiers. So the developed acreage and then what was underutilized, so had below 5% lot coverage, really low lot coverage, and then vacant properties. The areas that have some industrial lands in their inventory are sort of can be characterized differently. Finley, you have your sort of legacy fertilizer, chemical plants, and some limited development, but it seems to have slowed. And there are some large parcels there that are they're primarily in agricultural use, but are zoned industrial that it could support additional industrial use. But when you see a later map, you'll see we haven't seen the concentration of those uses there as much as in some other areas. But what we have seen is a lot of residential build out. And then northeast of Prosser, there's some small chunks of industrial zone land, smaller parcels, so more likely to see the light industrial type use, more residential. And then the interesting thing that I got out of this analysis is where you see industrial development that is out in the GMA agricultural zone, that is agriculture related, sort of that agri-industrial type use, and those uses, and then industrial use at the hubs, the sort of collection points for those agricultural products that are produced out in the wider GMA ag zone, along transportation corridors, those products require processing and storage. And those locations like Plymouth and Patterson are where we see some localized needs for to support additional industrial development. Next slide. Oh, got a couple more sort of smaller areas to mention. Whitstrand's got a small chunk of acreage that's mostly undeveloped or underdeveloped. You got the elementary school right across the street there that might limit some of the potential uses, but it is part of the picture there. And I think there could be some redevelopment of some of those properties. And then Plymouth, that's an area we focused on. We had a conversation with AgriNorthwest about their needs at the Plymouth Industrial Park. And again, the industrial use there is really focused on supporting surrounding agricultural land use. So it ties into the viability and protection of agricultural lands and to the larger picture of sort of value-added agricultural production. And it's in a location that has proximity to rail, to the river, to major highway interchange, and pretty good location for expansion of industrial use. Oh, and power transmission too. And next slide, please. So this is kind of the heat map. This was interesting. So to supplement the industrial zoning, I pulled together some data to try to get at where industrial type activity is occurring irrespective of zoning, and pulled in quite a few different data sets, stormwater, industrial stormwater permits from ecology. There's some OpenStreetMap has some publicly available data sets, and then the county's building permit database and kind of did some queries to figure out industrial building permits. So these the black dots you see are an aggregation of those data sets. And then the sort of heat polygons that you see, or the patches, are where there are concentrations of those types of development. And you can see kind of a Cambria industrial sort of farmshed that goes up from Patterson into that corridor along the state route there, that is their agricultural products. There's storage sort of in the outlying areas, so there's large scale onion and potato storage sheds being built. You know, those are providing local storage for products that are then moving down that that area towards the river. And you have some more intensive industrial uses. Obviously, Columbia Crest is there, sort of at the bottom of that large polygon. You've got some other hotspot. You got a hotspot in Plymouth, and a hotspot Prosser as well, with a lot of the fruit processing. There's a mint distilling facility. Some really interesting sort of agri-industrial value-added industrial uses. Any questions about this?
Those hot spots, you've got more acreage than what you had designated in those hot spots. Are those just associated agricultural with those industrial sites? Is that what you're doing?
So the software just sort of... it does an interpolation to try to give you a sense of where the most activity is happening across the whole landscape. So the hotspots aren't intended to draw a boundary that, like, this is exactly where the activity is occurring. It's just saying there's a concentration here with this is extent, and it's looking at all the points, and it's trying to draw, you know, it's doing a mathematical function to draw the best boundary it can around those points to show that that activity is concentrated there. So it's just a visual, I guess is a shorter way of saying it, just a visual representation of where there's a lot of points.
Okay.
Next slide. So you saw the hotspot around Plymouth and the things we mentioned about the industrial park. And we have talked to AgriNorthwest about their plans and needs at that industrial park. From those conversations, we've developed some recommendations for changes to accommodate those needs. You can see the two areas in red. Those are potential sites where they would like to consider land use designation changes to accommodate their growth at this site. So the first one, the one that says proposed change from GMA Ag to rural industrial, above the existing industrial park there, so you can see the rail loop. They would like to expand the rail loop into where that circle is, just west of the existing, and then expand out some other industrial uses to the north as well. And Ben, do you have anything to add to this?
Sure, thank you, Adam. Yeah, so this is some of the land that we moved from industrial into GMA Ag in 2018, and they said, hey, they didn't actually, we checked with them at the time, and I'm not sure we talked to exactly the right people, but once the change occurred, then the county heard about it. And they have, I don't know if you're aware, but so they've got a grain flaking facility that they are just almost completed construction on. They're testing it right now and fine tuning it so that they can take in corn, not just from their facility, but from other farms, and be able to provide food for, you know, dairy and beef cattle, feedlots, that kind of thing. And so it does kind of serve the larger region. They have more plans for that area. They're also building onion storage and packing facilities in this area as well. And they have vision of potential, you know, maybe barge plus rail down the road. And the other thing is they're getting a lot of inquiries. Like if you look at where industrial growth is occurring in a county, it's occurring in two areas. Out in the ag lands where the people are doing the storage facilities and that, like that hot spot that you were talking about, and down here in Plymouth. That's where the development has occurred. Findlay hasn't been hardly anything that's, I mean, Columbia Coal Store is probably the last big kind of development out there, and we know what happened to that facility. So in the Findlay area, there's nothing really new that's happened in Whitstan and Prosser, that are north of. Well, there's been a lot of work activity here in Prosser, but in the industrial areas, not as much. So these, the kind of the southern part of the county is kind of where the action's at, and it's all around ag value added. And then when you talk to some of the landowners down there, they're saying, well, yeah, and we've had businesses talk to us about like a metal fab shop that could kind of also complement what we have going on, some logistics businesses potentially, storage. So there's like this kind of cluster, and then you look across the river and you see what's happening with the server farms and kind of the industrial development that's also happening in Oregon, just across the river and in Morrow and Umatilla counties. They're seeing kind of this, you know, explosion in ag-related development as well, or the server farms, and we have some opportunity to take advantage of that, but a little more land would give us that much more opportunity. And the thing that we've talked about with Agri Northwest is like, well, where, what would you do with the land that's in production, the water that you're using to grow these circles? They're like, we have other areas that we would replace those circles with new circles that would, so there'd be like a no net loss of ag lands of long-term commercial significance. It would be, you know, more industrial development land opportunities on some of the land that's maybe has more marginal soils and conditions. They've developed other circles and in exchange, you know, be able to have more flexibility to do some of the development right next to the road and the rail and all that.
Yeah.
So, makes sense. So that's where we're at. There's one other slide. Adam, we'll go to the next slide. He can show you this piece here as well. And then, talk about next steps.
Yeah. So this little sliver, they would also like to change to rural industrial. And this is one of the ones he mentioned, Ben, about doing like metal fab or having some other light industrial complementary type uses.
Right. Thank you, Adam. I love that.
And on this one, you can see it's an irregularly shaped lot. It doesn't really lend itself to, you know, to irrigation. It's currently used for grazing, and again, they have opportunities to move that grazing to other, likely more suitable ground. This ground also has soil suitability limitations, so it makes sense in a lot of ways, and the barriers to removing the land from agricultural designation are fewer than they might be in other locations because it is fairly limited in its potential for use.
It's kind of interesting with Ag Reserves or Agri Northwest, because they have such a large land holding in the county and down in this area, they can kind of do a no net impact. So the irrigated ground will get moved to another location. The grazing will occur in another location. We don't really want to get into a lot of details, but we've also talked to them about conservation easements to protect habitat.
Yeah,
there's also, exactly, they have a bunch of it. They know that they need to offset some of their impacts with some more permanent protections. And so we're meeting with them, hopefully later this month and through the summer, to kind of talk through. We haven't even shared what you're seeing here. Well, they gave us this, so, but we have some like preliminary stuff that we're working up on where we might be able to do conservation easements. We'll share that with them. We'll get their feedback. And then when they're comfortable with, you know, what we're saying about their property, then there'll be an updated map presentation that we'll share with you that'll show you, all right, here's what might be industrial. Here are our new grazing grounds to replace these grounds. Here is conservation easement to replace, you know, this land that was in cheatgrass. It's going to go into production now. And here's the protection area. So you kind of see the full picture, you know, protected ag ground, protected conservation ground, and additional industrial development opportunities. And then we'll take input on it. And, you know, maybe not all of these go. Maybe we just start with a few of the, you know, however it ends up working out in the different alternatives that we look at. You're kind of getting an idea of where we're heading with this.
Okay. So do you have anything over at Patterson?
Patterson, right now we don't have anything, but that doesn't mean we couldn't. I was just thinking about that as I looked at the heat map.
Yeah.
I'm like, man, that corridor comes all the way down.
It does.
We probably ought to think about other areas in Patterson where maybe we consider more industrial land opportunity.
Yeah.
There's a GMA. One thing about industrial land and ag-related is you can do it almost anywhere in the GMA ag, right? So you have that kind of flexibility, but maybe there is kind of a cluster of supporting areas around Patterson.
Well, it would be, you'd have to talk to Sun Heaven Farms.
Yeah.
They have a lot of ground right along the Patterson corridor there.
Sure.
On both sides. And
yep.
So does San Michele. And,
yeah.
You know, a lot of other.
We got connections there.
Yeah. So
great. That's a really good point. Thank you for kind of putting a point on it.
One of my previous lives, I was irrigation coordinator for Benton PUD for all those large farmers out there.
Ah, okay.
So I did a lot of work with those.
You were the large customer rep or something?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, we helped them become more efficient.
Yeah.
At different types of projects.
Oh, nice. Great.
Yeah.
So where do we go from here? Well, I guess, are there any other questions about anything that we've heard tonight? And maybe we should ask Kelly or Debbie if they had any questions about what we've heard before we go into next steps. Comments? Okay.
I'm going to digest for a while.
She's going to digest.
Oh, yes. Yep. Great. We've been digesting some cookies and other things here. All right. So where do we go from here? We have our next workshop on the 24th. Housing, transportation, capital facilities is more going to be an update. We don't have an actual. We're going to have a draft that we're going to provide to Commerce of our updated capital facilities, but we're still collecting data from school districts, from the hospital districts, all of that. And so capital facilities is going to be more drafty, as I say.
Yep.
Agricultural lands, we'll have some more updated agricultural lands review information to share with you. And we'll actually have like a very preliminary draft alternative land use map for like alternatives 2 and 3. That we'll show you, and maybe that's where we look in Plymouth and Patterson, and like where could we have a lot of industrial land, or where could we have just more limited? And then in the fall, more workshops. Of course, we'll start doing some public open houses as we get more of the draft plan pieces pulled together and see if we can get some public input in addition to the guidance that you're providing us. The update on the alternative scenarios and the goals and policies. We're trying to have everything pulled together as an initial first draft by December. That could slip into January. And then a couple workshops in January and February, and then draft out for public comment along with the environmental impact statement and adoption later in the spring. That's the game plan. There is we're starting an ag tourism group to kind of give us some guidance on whether we need to look at maybe giving a little more flexibility in the GMA ag for some ag tourism related activities that are not just strictly production, We can't really share a lot right now because it's very early on in the process, but it's something we're looking at. We wanted to make you aware of. So,
such as wineries and things like that.
Well, the wineries are already existing. It would be more like, what kind of events could they hold there?
Like Wheatlands Brewery.
Well, Wheatlands Brewery.
Just throwing that out.
Yes, exactly.
More like goat yoga, pumpkin patches, other types of activities. And in that process, we will probably try to figure out how to address limited food services, but we're not aiming to see restaurants in the agricultural zones.
I get that, yeah.
Well said, Michelle. And yes, that was one of the ones that came up.
On a combine drag strip.
Yeah.
We'd
be competing against Lynn, yeah. But that's a demolition derby. Drag strip's a totally different game.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I don't see any land associated for casinos or anything like that for tourists, you know.
So agritourism.
You can get a winery.
Probably have to get a partnership with one of the tribes to make that happen.
Yeah.
All right.
I talked to you a little bit.
So the last item. Are you?
Okay.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Oh. No. He's got.
Oh, go ahead, Mark.
So Martin. Question. So going to the next steps. Going back to that slide. Housing.
Okay. So along that line, the HB 1337 bill that passed through the state for the additional ADUs per lot, they define it as lots. Okay, I was thinking we might think in terms of dwelling units, instead of lots, so you could call it instead of 12 lots maximum on a private road, for example, you could have, what would that be, 36 dwellings on that same road,
or 12 primary and up to 2 ADUs,
which would be, something's got to change, you know, because now if you can get 2 additional ADUs on a In addition to a residence, then you're going to have more traffic, you're going to have more everything.
All right, so as far as that goes, that bill only applies to the urban growth areas, and most of the time the urban growth areas are not consistently showing access easements, and so that 12-lot maximum that we have for private roads, that's for access easements and private roads. We don't see those often in the urban growth areas. We have a few in the Kennewick area left, but mainly that's not the type of development that we're seeing annexing or going into the city's urban growth areas. The 2 ADUs bill, which will be amending our development regulations after 2026, again, only applies to urban growth areas. We're not going to see that in the rural residential zone, so it's not going to be in RL5 or any of the residential zones.
So it is not accepted.
The counties are not allowed to have 2 ADUs in addition to the single primary residence. That's the state law, and we're pretty well versed in that. So it's only happening in the cities and the urban growth areas, because the state wants to see that
in the cities,
cities, it's going to be allowed, and then only in the urban growth areas for the county. The state doesn't want to see increased density in the rural areas, so we're not going to have more than 1 ADU right now in the rural areas.
So, okay.
And even that's touch and go. That may get appealed at some point, because we're not technically allowed to have those right now. So. We should be thankful that we do have detached ADUs in the rural areas.
As a condition.
Okay. So, yeah, we're not expecting to see any anticipate any increased density. So there's going to be no need for increasing private road maximums at this point.
I guess my question was, how can they discriminate? I mean, it's a lot. It's, you've got your services, you've got everything there. So, I mean, there's going to be a lawsuit down the line regarding that, for sure.
Yeah.
Because if you got to have it in municipals, but you move outside the city boundary, and all of a sudden you aren't allowed to have that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to go higher density with a lot of ADUs, they want it on city services. I mean, that just,
Makes sense.
It's the most cost-effective way to...
Yeah. I mean, you want your higher density where you have transit and you have different things that provide services, not out in the rural area.
Yeah. But the rural area people might feel different about that.
Well, you'll have to take it up with your state representatives then.
We do have rural community centers.
They fought over this topic in the legislature. And so it's been well. They've done a deep analysis of this topic. And there was lots of bills discussing in and out of UGAs. So.
One of the alternatives we may look at may have higher density in the rural community centers in Plymouth and out in Findlay.
Yeah, okay.
Just as a kind of an option to have a little higher density in those areas where you have more concentrated services. So.
All right. So the last matter of business that we have is this first floor of the courthouse. We have recently signed a lease. The county has recently signed a lease with the city of Prosser. So we will be losing our meeting space. With that, we have received approval by county administration to move our planning commission meetings to Kennewick, to the administration building in the Justice Center complex. Unfortunately, the second Tuesday of every month is already reserved for another board. And so we are asking you all to find a date that may work for you to have our reoccurring planning commission meeting. So we'll need to move it to a different night. So if you guys have a preference on a Monday or a Wednesday
or a Thursday,
I assume nobody wants to meet on a Friday night. Anyway, if you could let Brittany know
could do it like on the third Tuesday.
Yeah, the first Tuesday, the first Monday, the third, any of those types of days, if you could let Brittany know, that would be helpful. And we can also create a doodle poll if that would be easier for you guys to select the reoccurring date that might be better for you all.
Third Tuesdays usually work for me.
Third Tuesdays?
Yeah. For me, anyways.
It's in here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that change won't start until after July.
Okay, well, I could do that. Mondays are out for me, definitely. Can't do that. Wednesdays are kind of, I mean, I've got things going Wednesdays and Thursdays, but I can.
So would the first or the third Tuesdays work for most?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kelly, do you have any preference?
First or third.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, we will shoot for that, and then we will let you know when we will be convening our first meeting in Kennewick.
Right. So that'll be like on the second floor up there?
It's on the third floor of the administration building.
Okay.
There's elevators.
Yep.
Yeah.
There's elevators.
Right.
So. Oh, yeah. Close the door. And then we're done.
Yeah,
we're done. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, everybody. Have a good night.